Turn with me to 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel chapter 4. Verse 1, and what Samuel had said happened to all Israel. And Israel went out against the Philistines to battle and encamped beside Ebenezer, and the Philistines encamped in Aphek. And the Philistines put themselves in array against Israel, and the battle spread, and Israel was routed before the Philistines, and they slew in battle array in the field about 4,000 men. People came into the camp, and the elders of Israel said, "Why has Jehovah smitten us today before the Philistines? Let us fetch ourselves the Ark of the Covenant of Jehovah out of Shiloh, that it may come among us and save us out of the hand of our enemies." Verse 6, and the Philistines heard the noise of the shout and said, "What is the noise of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews?" And they understood that the ark of Jehovah had come into the camp. And the Philistines were afraid, for they said, "God has come into the camp." And they said, "Woe unto us, for there has not been such a thing heretofore." Verse 10, and the Philistines fought, and Israel was routed, and they fled every man to his tent, and there was a very great slaughter, and there fell of Israel 30,000 footmen, and the ark of God was taken, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. That's enough for now, and additional verses will come. Remember, we said that we've been looking at the ark in its varied aspects as brought before us in the scriptures, in the Old Testament scriptures. We saw the ark as the ark of the covenant. We saw the ark as the ark of the covenant of the Lord of all the earth. We saw the ark as the ark of Jehovah, and then the ark of testimony. And we simply said that in each aspect of the ark, it is the same ark, but it is just the different features that are emphasized as we get the names. And so we trust that by what we gave yesterday, we're all able to distinguish as we see the ark, what aspect of it is in view. And we linked those four aspects to the four Gospels. How the Lord Jesus is the ark brought out in every one of those gospels, so that we get a sense of the truth that the God has to give to us. Now, we ended yesterday on the ark being in the judges, and we said that the ark of God, after we saw it in Joshua, we never really see it again until the incident that we spoke of in Judges. And then the next time we see it now is in Samuel. And the book of Ruth comes in after Samuel, after Judges, and then we are led into the book of Samuel. And then we're going to see after Samuel, where goes the ark? And we're going to ask the question in the end, where it is. Okay? So I read these verses in 1 Samuel to bring out where the ark was in Samuel's day in Shiloh. Remember, we left indicating that in Judges, the ark was in Shiloh, which is a city of Canaan. And that's where it was in its temporary condition, if we might put it that way, until later on when David builds, through Solomon, builds a house for it. But in 1 Samuel chapter 4, what we have is shortly after Samuel was born And God had given Samuel a clear indication of the condition of things in that present day. Because there is a verse that says the word of Jehovah in chapter 3 of 1 Samuel was rare in those days. There was a sense of the absence of the word of Jehovah. And certainly when that is true, there will be great failure. Because it's the word of Jehovah, the presence of Jehovah, that makes a vast difference among the people of God. So the word of Jehovah was rare in those days. Remember, we are transitioning from Judges. At the end of Judges, what do we get? Everybody did what was right in his own eyes. Sounds like today, isn't it? The present day in which we live. The hostility of man. Indicative of the fact that man doesn't care about God. And we need to be challenged about that, because we need to ask ourselves as to how much is there the truth of Christ enjoyed by us. So it was rare in those days. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. And so after Samuel was born, remember, Samuel was born out of the basis of what? It was out of the cry of Hannah, who had looked around and things were in decadence. Things were in decay. Hannah looks around and she cries out to her God for a man child. It's not just because she was being persecuted by Penina that she wanted a child and because she was barren. But she was crying out because there were conditions in Israel that were indicative of the fact that God was not given his rightful place. And she's looking for a man child. And she cries and God gives her a man child. And she says, I'm going to lend him to you. First of all, I'm going to give. And then later on, I'm going to lend. And those two phrases are very important for your discernment as to what they mean. Nevertheless, Samuel comes on the scene. And Samuel gets a call one night. Samuel, Samuel. And he runs across to Eli and says, you called me. Eli says, no, I didn't call you. Go back and lay down. Gets another call. Goes back to Eli. You really called me? No, go back and lay down. Third time, he says, listen, next time you hear it, say, speak, Lord, for your servant hear it. Samuel was now in touch with the voice of God. And God gives him instructions concerning Eli, the priest, the man who should have been functioning effectively in his duties and in his household. He had two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, who would dip into the sacrifices and take advantage of it before God gets his portion. He had evil sons. And it says Eli was not rebuking them. So Samuel is now given a word from the Lord concerning what's going to happen to Eli, what's going to happen to the nation of Israel. But you know, Samuel didn't run around and say, you know, I'm going to go and pass on the message to Eli. He did not. Eli asked him, what did Jehovah say? Samuel was undoubtedly keeping it in his heart, meditating on the fact that, you know, there are going to be some unfortunate conditions and unfortunate circumstances that God is going to pour judgment. And he held it to himself. But then he, having been asked, he revealed it. And so in the chapter that's before us then is the matter of confrontation and conflict with the Philistines. The Philistines have always been a thorn in the side of the nation of Israel. If you go through, the Philistines were those in Abraham's day who did what? Stopped up the wells. They don't want the people of God to have refreshment. In Gideon's day, he dealt with the Midianites, but then there are others like, as we saw yesterday, who had to handle the Philistines type character. One would be Samson. What would the Philistines be in relation to Samson? They like to dig out the eyes of the people of God. They want to rob us of vision. So there are several features that we can look at at your leisure about the Philistines. But here is one. They want to do what? Rob the people of God of the ark. That's what the Philistines want to do. And so, they are in battle, verse 1. And then it says, Israel in verse 2 was routed by the Philistines. Israel, the people of God, are encountering the enemy, and God allows them to be defeated. And what happens? 4,000 in verse 2, I think it is. It says, and the Philistines put themselves in array against Israel, and the battle spread, and Israel was routed before the Philistines, and they slew in the battle in the field about 4,000 men. That's a kind of a formidable number. 4,000 of the Israelites are defeated by the Philistines. Now, what is God saying? Remember, we saw Israel before enjoying certain blessings from the hand of God. But when there is failure and departure, God will refuse to bless. He will withhold his blessing. And so this is what was happening here. His blessings were withheld from them. And they were routed, 4,000 of them. And so what do? They remembered the ark. They remembered the ark. Now we have to know whether this is convenience or reality. And we're going to see it as convenience rather than reality. They remembered the ark as to how well it did in the matter of the Jordan. They remembered the ark after that as to how well it did at Jericho. They remembered the ark definitely as to its divine power and resource. And so they figured, let's go get the ark. Let's fetch the ark. Since it did so well, let's use it again. Beloved, the ark is not a matter of convenience. Christ is not a matter of convenience. We can't use him when we feel we need him and discard him when we think we don't need him. And that discarding may not necessarily be an outward behavior of total apathy, but just the fact that, you know, we're comfortable, so we don't need the ark. Israel thought for a moment. You remember when they went up against Ai, we saw yesterday, that they were told, you don't need to send everybody, just 3,000 men, I think it was. Yeah, 3,000 men. We can handle it. We handled Jericho. We can handle Ai. Ai is a small matter. And remember what happened. They were defeated. It's the same principle here. Same principle. The Philistines are a strong, formidable force. But we'll go up against them. They were defeated. And then they said, well, all we need is get that little box. You know that little box, the ark of Jehovah? Just bring it into the camp, and that will take care of it. So what did they do? They brought it in. They brought it in as a magic wand. Let's just wave it over the Philistines, and boy, will they ever disappear. A magic wand. If not a magic wand, it's a good luck charm. It will bring us positive results. Just bring it in. And so they did. You see the mentality, how easy it is for us to slip away from the truth, from the greatness of Christ. And when we slip away from the greatness of Christ, everything comes in. Different opinions and things that we will just accept as being plausible. But God is going to take a stand. They brought in the ark, the supposed good luck charm. And it says in verse 4, Hophni and Phinehas stood by the ark. Sounds as though these are men who have good quality, right? They stood by the ark. Sure, standing by the ark is an important thing. Standing by Christ and the truth concerning him is an important thing. But it cannot be out of convenience. They stood by the ark.
They were men who had no relationship to the ark. They were just there. They had a name to live up to. They had their father's name, Eli, to live up to. It's like the prophets, the sons of the prophets in 2 Kings. The sons of the prophets are always named as running around and doing things. You remember when Elijah was to be taken up and Elisha was to take over? The sons of the prophets bugged the life out of Elisha, constantly behind him. Do you know your master is going to be taken today? He almost said to them, leave me alone. They kept bugging and bugging and bugging. But let me tell you who the sons of the prophets are. They are men who are associated with the prophetic voice, but don't have any reality as connected with it. That's why those of us who've come from households of parents who have followed the Lord, it's not a matter of following the Lord in name. It has to be in reality. We can't just talk about, well, I'm like my father, or you are like your father or mother. Their name doesn't get us along. There comes a point in time in our experiences that the things that they have deposited with us must be taken up personally. The sons of the prophets didn't do that. They followed the prophetic connection of their fathers, but never had the reality associated with it. So was Hophni and Phinehas. They were sons of the priests, but had no priestly exercise. They stood by the ark. Israel is routed. 30,000 footmen in verse 10 are slain. That's a lot. This time with the presence of the ark. Without the presence of the ark, how many did we have? 4,000. Now the presence of the ark has come in. How many were slain? 30,000. Well, you would think this should have been a reverse, shouldn't it have been? The ark should have answered to the need, but it did not. Why? Because God is not going to be used out of convenience. So we've got 30,000 footmen. And most of all, verse 11, the ark of Jehovah is taken. The ark is taken. This is a baffling experience. Because you wonder, why would God, as it were, remove his presence from his people and allow that article that represents his presence to be put in the hand of the enemy? Why would God do that? It sort of reminds me of the captivity, the Babylonish captivity. The people of God had gotten to a point in their experiences where God was no longer held in high esteem. He had started with 2.5 tribes, I think it was the number, and then 7.5 that went into the Assyrian captivity after the Rehoboam and Jeroboam situation. They had gone into the Assyrian captivity, and Judah was left. And ultimately now, who goes into captivity, the Babylonish captivity? The two tribes. He puts them into captivity to teach them a lesson concerning his greatness. And I believe that this is what is happening here. He's teaching them a lesson concerning his greatness by allowing himself, the Ark of the Covenant of Jehovah, to be taken by the Philistines in battle. The result? Hophni and Phinehas dies in the battle. God is allowing circumstances to remove them, having the kind of character that they had in relation to the testimony of God. Hophni and Phinehas die. And then later on in verse 18, who also dies? But Eli, the priest. He couldn't take the news that the ark, what is of value to the nation of Israel, had been brought into captivity, had been captured by the Philistines. He could not take it, it says. It came to pass when the mention of the ark of God that he fell from off the seat backward by the side of the gate, his neck broke and he died. Now you notice where he was? He was sitting. He was sitting. Have you ever seen a priest sitting? Go back to the Old Testament. There was no seat in the house of God for the priest to sit. The priest's function was a function of activity. Eli should have been standing. Eli went and found himself a little chair to sit on. And because he was sitting, he did not attend to the service of God appropriately, because he didn't regulate his sons Hophni and Phinehas, because he was sitting too much. And while on the place where he was sitting, what happens? The very seat that he had made for his own comfort is the thing that caused his death. He fell off of it and broke his neck. The very things that we bring along to make comfortable for ourselves can be our detriment. Eli dies, the ark is taken. But there is a beautiful piece that ends this chapter 4. Phinehas' wife was with child, and she was ready to deliver. She travailed, and she gave birth to a child, a son, and she called his name Ichabod. Ichabod. While she was giving birth, and she travailed, she says, Ichabod means the glory has departed. She was a woman who was in tune with the condition of things. That the glory of God in the ark being taken had departed from Israel. It's nice to think of women, brethren, sisters in the assembly. They serve a wonderful place. Very often God uses them when us men are in states of failure. He uses them when we are in states of failure. Here is a woman. She's able to estimate rightly how God is affected by the ark being taken. And she calls the son Ichabod. The glory is departed because the ark of God was taken, and her father-in-law and her husband. The glory is departed from Israel, for the ark of God is taken. What a sad day it was. Double sadness for her. She was travailing. She was going through birth pains. And at the same time, in conjunction with that, the ark of God is taken. Well, what happens then from here? The ark is gone. Israel is left without that article that is representative of the presence of God. Therefore, where do we go from here? In chapter 5, let's talk about what has happened. The ark of God is now in the hands of the Philistines. And what is going to happen? Let's see how God operates. God moves, says the songwriter, in mysterious ways, his wonders to proclaim. He plants his footsteps in the seas, and he rides upon the storm. Can anyone capture God? No, he's in charge. He knows what he allows, and he allows it for a purpose, so that he might bring his purpose to pass. So they took, in chapter 5, the Philistines took the ark, and they took it up from Ebenezer to Ashdod. Ebenezer is a wonderful name. Hitherto hath the Lord helped us. You'd be surprised to know that that's my middle name. Hitherto hath the Lord helped us. From Ebenezer, the place of blessing, to Ashdod, the place where all the gods are. That's where they took him. That's where they took the article. And now God is going to vindicate himself and prove himself to be who he says he is. So they bring the ark into the house of Dagon, the god of Ashdod. They brought the ark there. Now, the Philistines were really saying to themselves, we've got him. We've got him now. There is no God any longer in Israel. We have captured him. And if any way he might be of help to us, that's what will happen. But other than that, there is going to be no further victory. We are settled at the fact that there is going to be nothing to disturb our ascendancy. Yes? What happens? They brought him into the house of Dagon and they set him up right next to Dagon. Rivalry, isn't it? They set him up right next to Dagon. At least if there's any power in this box, Dagon can extract some of the power for himself. Other than that, there's going to be no victory. So they set him up next to Dagon. And the next day in verse 3 of chapter 5, what happens? Dagon, when they woke up in the morning, when Dagon woke up in the morning, he found his head on the ground. Can you imagine? When Dagon woke up in the morning, his head was on the ground. His face to the ground. And where was he? His face to the ground, facing the ark. Can you imagine? Even this inanimate object of Dagon was given credence and obeisance to the ark in that sense. His face is on the ground. So what do? They take Dagon and upright him. They said maybe something just unusually happened. So let's put him back up. So they put him back up in verse 3 or 4. And then the next day, in verse 3, they set him back up. And the next day again, early in the morning, they found Dagon. Not only did he fall on his face before the ark of Jehovah, the head of Dagon, and both the palms of his hands were cut off from the threshold to the fish dump. Now there's further disaster. His head fell off. He was falling to the ground. His head is off. His hands are cut off, as it were. And every evidence is there that Dagon has no supremacy whatsoever at all over the greatness of the presence of God. Now, 2 mornings, right? How much more do you need to prove that Dagon is not God? This was enough for the Philistines. It says, therefore, neither the priest of Dagon nor any that come into Dagon's house tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this day. They're scared to death. Because a box that represented the presence of God had superseded the supposed power of Dagon. And there was nothing left. Dagon is defeated. In verse 8, the thought now is this. We cannot allow the ark to remain with us. It's too devastating. It's too costly. It's robbing us and our God Dagon of his right. Because there is one who supersedes, and that is God himself. Let's send it away. So in verse 8, let the ark of the God of Israel be carried about to Gath. That's where the giant was, right? And they carried the ark of God of Israel about thither. And it came to pass that after they had carried it about, the hand of Jehovah was against the city with very great panic. So not only Dagon is affected, but the entire city is experiencing the power of God in how he is manifesting himself against every idol that arises. You remember what the first commandment is? Thou shalt have no other God besides me. And God is going to make sure that his supremacy is maintained. So they eventually, in verse 10, sent it to Ekron. It came to pass when the ark of God came to Ekron that the Ekronites cried out, saying, they have brought about the ark of the God of Israel to us to kill us. Please, don't bring him here. His power is too great. It is greater than our God. We don't want him here. Get rid of him. So it remained in chapter 6 and verse 1. It remained for 7 months in the hand of the Philistines. And you know, those 7 months were months of torment. They were months that were highly testing for the Philistines. The God of all the universe was in their midst. And he was upsetting the apple cart. He was turning everything upside down so that his presence might be known. And so the time has come. Let's get rid of the ark after 7 months in our hands, causing us great distress. So what did they do? They decided we're going to send it away. It's better off that we do without it so that our Dagon might continue to do his nonsense. Let him continue, but let's get rid of this ark. It is of no pleasure to keep the ark of God amongst us. He will continue to defeat us. So in chapter 6, you can look at this at your leisure. There were two milch kine cows that were used to cart the ark up to Beth Shemesh. They got a new cart. The Philistines got a new cart, placed the ark on it. The two milch cows that had just given birth were given the ability to take the ark up to Beth Shemesh. A very difficult situation for those cows and their young ones because they were taken away from them. And so they were taken up, the ark was taken up to Beth Shemesh. And what happens there? As it went, we're told in chapter 6, the kine went straight forward on the way to Beth Shemesh, verse 12. They went by the one highway, lowing as they went, feeling the pain of having left their young. And they turned not aside to the right hand or to the left. And the lords of the Philistines went after them as far as the border of Beth Shemesh. And they of Beth Shemesh were reaping the wheat harvest in the valley. And they lifted up their eyes and they saw this cart coming in the parade. And when it got to Beth Shemesh, you know what? Some of the men of Beth Shemesh decided they were very intrigued about this thing coming in to their midst. Let's go take a look. Let's go take a look. And they went and they peeped into the ark. You know what happened? They were killed. The seriousness, the greatness, the glory of the presence of God is not something for us to simply handle in an indifferent way. It's not a moment for curiosity. There is no spectatorship where God is concerned. It's a matter of serious things. You don't go and peep at God. You don't go and try to see if we can get a little glimpse. It's a matter of what is serious. They looked into the ark upon the glory of God and they were killed. I'm thinking of Moses, you remember? He wanted to see God. You remember what God told him? There's a little rock there. I'm going to hide you in the rock. You'll see my back parts as I move. But I'm going to put you in the cleft of the rock. You know that's how we see the glory of God now? Because we're in the cleft of the rock. We who are his, who have, as we said yesterday, the treasure in earthen vessels. So that we can now look at the glory of God where? In the face of Jesus Christ. This is the privilege of the Christian company, that we can look on the ark. And we don't look on it out of curiosity or any other osities. We look upon it for contemplation, and we're able to come into the knowledge of the glory of God resident in the face of Jesus. So they looked upon it, and they died at Beth Shemesh. Now the ark was taken from off this cart, and it was found in the household of Abinadab. And let's move on to that. In chapter 7, verse 1, it says, "And the men of Kirjath-Jearim came, they fetched up the ark from the men of Beth Shemesh, and they brought it into the house of Abinadab on the hill, and hallowed Eleazar his son to keep the ark of Jehovah." The ark of Jehovah. The one who has right and authority. He's the one who, in the essence of his person, is essentially, intrinsically, God over all, blessed forever. This is the one that Abinadab's son Eleazar is going to be put in charge of. And I have no doubt that Eleazar took this matter seriously. I have no doubt that he, it says, they hallowed him, which means he had to come under conditions of purity. He had to come under conditions of suitability to handle divine things. And that's how we have to be. Suitable persons to handle divine things. Eleazar was made suitable. He had to be in a condition of having clean hands and a holy heart. And it says, the ark was there in under Eleazar's care for approximately 20 years. There's a little give or take here or there. Verse 2 tells us that it was in Abinadab's household for approximately 20 years. Now, can you imagine what must have happened in those 20 years? It doesn't tell us that anybody ever died in Eliezer's household, the household of Abinadab. No. It just simply says it was there. I have no doubt that there was a household that had a sense of the gravity and the greatness of who the ark represented, and they maintained the integrity of it on a day-by-day basis. There was no room for flippancy. There was no room whatsoever for any kind of lethargic, indifferent responses. They looked at the ark every day and kept it as an object of attraction. I'm thinking maybe it could be the principle here of what took place in Egypt on that night, the Passover. You remember they were to take the lamb and hold it for 4 days? And I can imagine in those 4 days the kids running in and out of the house, and the lamb is there, and they're enjoying it and delighting in the lamb and becoming friendly with it and attached to it. And then on the fourth day, their dad says, "We've got to kill this lamb." What a heart-rending thing it must have been. They'd gotten accustomed to the lamb. I believe in Abinadab's house, it's the same principle. They'd gotten accustomed to the ark being there for some 20-odd years, and they valued it and treated it with the highest dignity. And now all of a sudden, the ark is going to be moved. Let's move on. In chapter 6 of 2 Samuel is the next appearance of the ark. Chapter 6, 2 Samuel. David is on the scene now. He's the king. And David wants to prepare a place for the ark. And let me just read Psalm 132 and a verse there that will help us to appreciate David's desire. It says, Psalm 132, "Jehovah, remember for David all his affliction, how he swore unto Jehovah, vowed unto the mighty one of Jacob, I will not come into the tent of my house. I will not go up to the couch of my bed. I will not give sleep to mine eyes, slumber to mine eyelids, until I find out a place for Jehovah, a habitation for the mighty one of Jacob." And he says, "Let me tell you where I found the ark. Behold, we heard of it, the ark, at Ephrathah,
We found it in the fields of the wood.
That's where David says, I found it. That's at the time of which we're going to look at now. The ark is in Abinadab's household after having gone through the experiences with the Philistines. And now it's time to bring it up. And what does David do in 2 Samuel 6? He prepares to bring it up. And he goes out and gets himself a new cart. Gets himself a new cart. Where did he get that from? He got it from the Philistines. The Philistines brought it up to Beth Shemesh on a new cart. At least you give them a certain measure of credit. Because it doesn't say they put it on an old cart. Because an old cart would have meant that it had to have been used before. And Christ, as he was put into a brand new tomb, has to always have supremacy. He got a new cart by the Philistines. And God respected that. But David went out now and bought himself a new cart. And God says, I can't respect that. I will not respect that, David. You know better. You remember what we said in Numbers. There were no wagons provided for bringing up the holy articles. The only wagons were given to the Gershonites and the Merarites. None for Kohathites. The Ark of the Covenant of Jehovah is to be transported. That's what we saw in Exodus 25. The staves going through the rings so that there is transport by the priest of the Ark. So David is lost here. He's gotten a new cart. And the sons of Abinadab, unfortunately, these are the sons who were there in the house of Abinadab. They are now the responsible ones to see to it that the cart is being moved effectively along the way. And we're told that in verse 6, as the cart is going along, it's often said that the ark stumbled. No. It's not the ark that stumbled. It's the cart. Not the ark. The cart. Read verse 6. What does it say? And when they came to Nacon's threshing floor, Uzzah reached after the ark of God and took hold of it, for the oxen, rather, stumbled. Not the cart. Not the ark of Jehovah. The oxen stumbled. And so Uzzah is thinking, if the oxen is stumbling, it means then that the ark is going to stumble. That's in his mind. You know, you see how we orchestrate things in our minds. And that's what gets us in trouble. And so immediately, Uzzah reaches out. And what happens? Instantaneous death. God doesn't stumble. He cannot stumble. He's firm. He's as firm as a rock. Sure as a rock. And so Uzzah reaches to steady it, and he's killed. We're in a serious condition here now, says David. This is awful. Why would God interpose himself in judgment when we are attempting to do what's right? I can imagine that's the thought in David's mind. I am doing what is right. The ark had been captured by the Philistines. I am recovering it. I'm bringing it home to its rightful place. Why is it that there should be death ensuing such an action? It shows to us, it matters not, brethren. We might do a right thing in a wrong way. We can do a right thing in a wrong way. It was a right thing to bring up the ark. It was. Because the ark belongs among the people of God. It's a right thing to bring it home. But it's a wrong thing to use methods that are not wholly sanctified of God. And this is what David was using. A method of the world. Now the world has a lot of methods. The world says, let's adjust. Let's make it palatable. Let's make it easy. Let's make it acceptable. God says, you don't change my standards. They are irrevocable. They're not to be changed.
David, do you remember
how the ark is to be transported? The ark is then brought now to the house of Obadiah, the Gittite, a stranger. There had to be a halt. There needs to be a time now for contemplation. There were 20 years for contemplation in the household of Abinadab. And Eliezer had the experience of that. But now there's another pause, another period for contemplation, a period of 3 months. The ark went into the household of Obadiah. And I'm excited when I think of the household of Obadiah. I can just imagine what went on there. The ark in its rightful place in the house was not just pushed in the corner, wasn't given a basement place, it wasn't given some place of insignificance, but it was given the place of supremacy. I can imagine in Obadiah's house, no one is to enter where that ark is. It has to have its highest honor given to it. And every day I can see Obadiah rising and going in to have communion with the ark. It would be like Enoch. It says Enoch walked with God. Every morning Enoch woke up, his first thought was, I got to go meet God. I have to go and meet God. Every morning, I must meet God this morning. That's what the statement says. You must meet God in the morning if you're going to experience him through the day. Enoch said, yes, I must go. Obadiah says, I must go in and look at the ark. And it was not looking at the ark now with curiosity like the men of Beth Shemesh. No, Obadiah is enjoying the greatness and the glory of the ark. And for 3 months he had that. And then there came a point in time where it says in verse 12, Jehovah blessed the house of Obadiah. God is a blesser God, isn't he? That he will not allow us to lose out if we are going to be in the pathway of obedience. So he blesses the house of Obadiah. Then it says, David hears of that. And he says, we've got to get the ark up. Obadiah, you are getting a massive blessing here. But remember, this blessing belongs to the nation of Israel. We need to have everyone brought in to the value of the ark. Not just Obadiah's household, but all the saints. And that's what I think God wants for all of us, to be in the good, in the gain, and the blessing of what the ark of Christ sets before us. So that the assembly, individual assemblies and local assemblies, can enjoy the greatness of what God has given to us in Christ. So David orchestrates everything now to bring the ark from Obadiah's house, and he's doing it with joy. He's now learned the lesson. David has been able to go back to the book of Numbers. He's gone back to Exodus. He's looked at the scroll and he's able to see who is supposed to bring up the ark, how it is supposed to be transported, and what does he do? He gets the priest in order and sets things in motion. Verse 16. As the ark of Jehovah came out into the city of David, Michal, the daughter of Saul, looked through a window and saw King David leaping, dancing before Jehovah, and she despised him. Now look at David's response. You remember before when Uzzah was killed? A sad demeanor. Disappointed that God had taken such a decisive act against Uzzah. But now he's in the spirit of rejoicing, because he knows that he's moving in the mind of God, in the vein of God, in the thoughts of God. He's moving. He's bringing the ark up, and there is a rejoicing, great rejoicing before the ark. And it says in verse 17, David spread a tent for it and placed it in the midst
of the tent. And then what flows from it? Tremendous sacrifices, offerings.
There was a great appreciation of the glory of God, the greatness of God, and the sacrifices poured out that speak to us of the death of Christ, of whom the ark speaks. So there is a real abundance of rejoicing that is taking place in the bringing home of the ark by David.
Now I'm going to finish this off now with just going to 2 Chronicles 5. Second Chronicles 5, and I'll just call out the verses as I go along and close off.
Now, we've come to the point where in the city of David, the ark is there. It's resting there. It has found a place by David, and it is going to remain there until the completion of the temple by Solomon, at which time the ark is to be brought in.
It does not have a house. David was a man on the deep exercise, you remember? That he was going to build a house for Jehovah. And Nathan says to him, what? Go right ahead. It's your heart's desire. Go right ahead. Build a house. God says to Nathan, hold it. I didn't tell you to tell David that.
I don't want David to build an ark, a house for me, for the ark to be placed. No, because David has been a man who was a military man and military might. He's conquered the Philistines. He's had a lot of battling to do. He's a man with his hands full of blood.
I don't want a bloody hand to build me a house. His son, Solomon, will do so. So Nathan had to go back and tell David. Nope, David, not you. But you know what? David is not a disappointed man, you know. I might have been. I didn't get a chance to do what I wanted to do. Therefore, I'm not going to do anything. All right, you want my son to do it? Let him go ahead and do it. What does David do? David supplies abundantly out of his affection, out of his affliction. He supplies abundantly for the building of the house. He says, oh God, if you don't want me to do it, I will use whatever resources I have, making them available for you. And that's what David did. So in chapter 5 of 2 Chronicles, verse 1, the work of the temple is finished. Just like we saw in Exodus 40, you remember, when the work of the tabernacle was finished, Moses does what? He gathers all the articles, and particularly he gathers the ark, and he brings it into its rightful place. Here it's the same thing. The temple is built. God's house that Solomon had built is finished. And what does Solomon do? It says, Solomon brought in the things that David his father had dedicated, the silver, the gold, the vessels. He put among the treasures of the house of God. And then he does this. He assembles the elders of Israel, the heads of the tribes, the princes of the fathers of the children of Israel to Jerusalem to bring up the Ark of the Covenant of Jehovah. The Ark of the Covenant. It's the Ark that speaks of the rights of Jehovah, of the authority of Jehovah. There is only one man in whom those rights were present. It's Christ, of which the Ark speaks. The Ark of the Covenant. It's God's covenanted relationship with his people that's emphasized here. And then verse 4. The Levites took up the Ark. What a day. The Levites took up the Ark. Again, it reminds me of Simeon, as we said yesterday. Simeon took up that Ark. You remember the babe coming in? When Simeon came into the temple, the babe was brought in. Simeon had the competency, the ability to take up the babe. What arms? Arms that embraced the God of the universe who was there in a child. What affection, what attachment Simeon had to that. He said, oh, now lettest thou
thy servant depart. It's as though he said, I had enough. I'm always reminded of Jacob.
When he looked out and saw the wagons sent to bring him down to Egypt by Joseph, he says, it is enough. It is enough. I ask no more. That's his impression. All along he was disbelieving the fact that Joseph was alive. But when he saw the wagons, he said, it is enough.
So the Levites picked up the ark, verse 4. And then in verse 6, there are a tremendous number of sacrifices. Just as there was in David bringing the ark up from Obed-Edom. And it says, they put the ark of the covenant of Jehovah in its place. Verse 7. The priests brought in the ark of the covenant of Jehovah to its place, into the oracle of the house, into the most holy place, under the wings of the cherubim.
The ark is in its place. Rightfully so.
Rightfully where it belongs. And it says, there it is to today.
They brought it in. Put it there. What happens after that? You can read those verses. It says the staves were removed. I wonder why. Can you imagine why? There is to be no more journeyings. There is to be no more wilderness experience for the carrying of the ark. The staves are out. It's in its final resting place. It's the truth of John 14. Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house there are many mansions. If it were not so, I would not have told you. I go to prepare a place for you, that where I am, I'm just paraphrasing, where I am, there you may be also. That's the ark at rest. That's the Lord Jesus as the ark at home in the Father's house, and we with him, and there is no more wilderness experience. That's what you have here. And you know what confirms that? Do you notice what was in the ark in 2 Chronicles 5? Take a look at it. What's in the ark? Verse 10. There was nothing in the ark save the two tables which Moses put there at Horeb, when Jehovah made a covenant with the children of Israel when they came out of Egypt. Think of it. You remember I told you yesterday that in the ark were the two tables of stone. There was Aaron's rod that budded, and then there was the pot of manna. So what has happened to Aaron's rod that budded? What has happened to the pot of manna? No more need for it. The only thing we need and will have for all eternity is the Ark of the Covenant of Jehovah, the mind of God, the two tables of stone. His mind will go through all the way through eternity. There are those today, if you had an opportunity to do, like my wife and I, to visit Ethiopia, it is felt that the ark, and this is a feeling, that the ark resides at Aksum, a little island off Ethiopia, and it is guarded supposedly by several monks. Night and day, like the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier here, it's guarded, supposedly, that's where the ark is. But we know where the ark is. The ark is Christ, and he is at the right hand of the glory of the Majesty on high. And that's what suffices us. We know where to go and look for it. May God encourage our hearts then. Trust that we have not overstepped our time. But I thought that this exercise would be helpful in helping us to appreciate God as seen in the ark, Christ the ark, and its movements through this scene, in this wilderness scene, as we go through with a view to arriving home at glory, where all will be eternal rest, for his name's sake.